You had so many guests last time.
This site has 483 content types. They want it cheap. Errors and warnings and notices all over. Who wrote this thing? Bleep! Agony! No frustration more sore. For those kittens were killed when some stupid idiot hacked core.
This Hello and welcome to Drupal Easy Podcast number 159 for Thursday, July 16th, 2015. I am your host for today, Ryan Price, and I am here more or less all by myself compared to a regular day when we have Mike and Ted and Andrew and a bunch of other folks hanging around. But the show must go on, and today we have a guest who is actually a coworker of mine at FFW. His name is Leonid Makarov, and he is the chief architect at FFW, the East Coast America division. Leonid, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ryan. Welcome, everyone.
Yeah. So we have you on today because we're going to be talking about some sort of new hot stuff in the sort of web server world, but I think specifically we're going to be applying it to, like, you know, how a team like FFW is using it in their local development environment. And then, and specifically there's like a project that you are kind of spearheading inside of FFW that's called Druid. So we're going to get up to all that. But before we do, I just want to ask you a little bit about you. First of all, you are in America right now, but I'm imagining you're not always been an American.
No. So I moved to America in specifically to New Jersey in 2008. At that point, I already worked for Blink for about 2 years. I started in 2006, so it was 9 years this April. When I look back, it's a lot of years spent, and I really... Blink, well, now FW went from just basically three developers. When I was hired, I was person number two on the team, to about 150 developers before we were acquired by Intellect and merged into the FFW together with Pro People and several other companies. And I think we're now probably up to like 500 people total, so it's a huge growth. Lots of years, lots of exciting things, painful things as well, challenges, stress, but also fun. It was a long journey to date.
Yeah. So were you working on Drupal before Blink Reaction, or was that kind of like your introduction to the technology?
No, I was actually hired to work on Drupal projects, or to start working, and we've been trying to figure out where that actually came from, but it is kind of a mystery. So I knew no Drupal at all. In 2006, it was version 4.6. It's the first one that I started using, and it was a project, an intranet project for one of the first Blink's clients that I was putting together all by myself. Learning Drupal, hacking core, because I didn't really know anything about Drupal, and it was quite painful for about a year or so. I didn't really have anyone else helping out. So I didn't know anyone in the community. I didn't even know that the community existed back then. And yeah, it was mostly just me trying to figure out how this thing works and how to build the sites with it. And it was fine as long as you stick to whatever comes out of the box, but then when you try to do something outside of just the administrative UI and contrips, that was basically killing kittens by hacking core for a while.
So I guess, how did you get into being a web developer? Like, did you study computer science, or did you kind of just pick it up?
I actually studied computer science. I'm actually pretty late compared to when kids get acquainted with computers and smartphones today. My parents bought me my first computer when I was, I think, 14 or 15. And so that's when I started kind of getting familiar with computers. And at some point I realized that I really like that and I would really like to pursue a career in something related to computers. Though my parents being engineers in a completely different domain, they are gas turbine engineers. But again, being an engineer in a post-Soviet country, I come from Ukraine, at some point became really frustrating because everything was falling apart. And my parents actually started this journey of, I guess, immigration, because they first moved to Czech Republic. They work for a really large company there, probably well-known in Europe, Škoda. They do cars, but also they do different other things like gas turbines. So it's similar to probably GE. My mom actually works for GE now in Moscow. Yeah, so I was told to never become an engineer, and I didn't obey that. And I decided that I do want to be involved with computers, so I studied computer science. I received my bachelor's and then master's degree. I started my PhD program, had to quit because of the relocation to US. Then web development, we did not really have too many subjects related to web. Well, actually we did, but they were some basic like HTML, CSS, JavaScript. There were really no well-known CMSs at that point. I started by, we had a project internally in the university that we had to put together a system for tracking hours and putting together a learning schedule. And that was an assignment. I had to kind of put the team together. We all work on that. So I started putting something together with PHP. I was learning PHP at that point, and I think that's the first time I actually got acquainted with PHP and the LAMP stack, and that kicked off my web journey, I guess. I don't really remember how exactly or who introduced me to PHP, but for some reason that was a choice at that point for a web project. For some reason, I decided that project should really be a web project. Working with it would be much easier compared to everyone having to download some binary, installing it. that was just a lot of random choices, I guess, which probably made sense at that point when I was just introducing myself to web in general. And that's basically the path I took. And then after that project, I did some freelance for not too long, maybe several months. And that was pretty intense because I really had to work 16 hours a day trying to put together some informational sites. I started putting together my own CMS because I realized that there has to be a way to do it faster. Again, there were not really too many CMSs around at that point or that I knew about. Yeah, and then I was interviewed and hired for an outsourcing company called GlobalLogic, which Blink was client of, and that's how I kind of got into the Blink Reaction and into Drupal. I was hired to do Drupal projects, and no one really remembers why there was a decision to start to do Drupal back in 2006. And for a while,
Blink, in the beginning, Blink did a lot of different technologies.
In the beginning, Blink was really a franchise company that was doing IT support, primarily IT support, actually. There was a small group, about three people, that started doing websites. And I was hired for that group. Basically, I was the third employee in that group, the second employee. Over time, That division started to grow. We started to get more clients, bigger clients. We did Drupal. We did CMS Made Simple for informational sites. We even did OS Commerce, if anyone remembers what that was, for like e-commerce sites. And we did quite a bunch of them. All of those sites at some point got hacked because OS Commerce is a pile of you know what. And yeah, I'm glad we gave up all of that. We just decided that at some point to focus on Drupal only. And that's when Blink really started to grow, because that was a really good decision made by our CEO to really focus on Drupal only. And that's how we started to grow and became Blink Reaction. And now FFW, part of the Intellecta Group, and probably the largest Drupal shop in the world. or at least that's what we are telling everyone.
that's the line, right? Very cool. So when you're working at Blink and the team's growing and growing and growing, right? Now when you're talking about you're the chief architect and there are potentially, you know, 100 and something other developers and QA people that could all be working on something, you want to come by and you want to see maybe something commonly represented. Is that kind of where the need to want to scratch an itch for having like a standardized local development environment comes from?
Yeah, at some point we realized that, and this was the topic that we were coming back to or coming to many times over time, but at some point we decided to trace down how much time we actually spent onboarding people on a project. Those numbers are amazing in that sense. And I think I was reading others talking about like standardizing dev environments and why this is important. It looks like it is the same anywhere in any technology company, in any company that does development, not only web development. People can easily spend days setting up their local environments up to company standards, even if there are instructions in the company wiki as for how to set it up. You still have to follow those instructions. You have to install a particular version of operating system inside of your virtual machine, or maybe just start installing packages and dependencies right onto your host computer. And many, many steps to do that. Frustration because instructions are outdated and some dependencies are no longer met or working, or something is broken. And yeah, people are on their own trying to figure that out, frustrated, want to cry, and then maybe someone more senior is going to help them, and then the senior person has to kind of spend this time instead of working on a project to help onboard someone else. So really, streamlining this procedure is key to making the onboarding process efficient and not as frustrated. It doesn't really have to be frustrated. It has to be exciting when someone can just come in, click a link to download a package or a tool, run a command, and get up and running with the entire stack for the project, including the project source code and database, and be able just to code. Because developers really, that's what they have to do. They should be coding, not trying to figure out how to set up the environment.
Okay, so I just want to pick out one thing you just said. It's not just that there's a development environment that everybody in the company can use, but there is a project-specific configuration of it so that if there are five or six people working on one project, we all can have that script that's just for this, you know, I guess a past project. Blink Reaction worked on the September 11th Memorial in New York, right? So for all the people that were working on that project, they would all be sharing this one sort of like 9/11 version of the local development environment. It's not just like that there's this generic platform, but it can get customized for each individual project, right?
Right. It can be customized for sure. And so usually it is the same set of components and versions because majority of our clients hosted with Acquia, so it's pretty much standard stack and we know what the versions are. But sometimes, like I will give you a good example with Compass and SAS, people install GEMS and Bundler and they usually will get different versions of some of those components. I know that can be resolved with a GEM file and a GEM log file, but not everyone really follows those best practices. And people will get different versions of the same tools installed. And the compiled CSS will just look different, or the results will be less predictable. It is really important not only to have like the same versions of PHP for compatibility reasons, but also the same versions of other tools involved in the web development process. So the argument works on my local should no longer be a case. It has to be the same exact environment for everyone. And in most cases, it probably will be the same exact environment for everyone in the entire company for developers. But if there is a need to have a different version of a particular tool, let's say a particular project instead of using PHP, 5.3, which is end of life long ago. But again, it's kind of for existing projects, it's a lot of effort. It could be a lot of effort to transition from to a newer version, like 5.5 or 5.6, because of the older versions of modules and dependencies on the PHP version there. But that is an example that we ran recently into, that one project has to use PHP 5.3 because it's still an old Drupal 6 site and the customer has no intent to upgrade it to anything newer than that. While other projects, new projects, want to be up to speed with the current versions of PHP and they need PHP 5.6. So you can do this with tools like the Acquia Dev Desktop or maybe MAMP or WAMP on Windows. You can switch PHP versions. With virtual machines, you would probably have to re-download a different version of a virtual machine or maybe reprovision it and wait those 10 or 20 minutes for the entire thing to be reinstalled. And what we're trying to achieve here is that you can just switch a line in your configuration file, restart the stack, and you get a new version or a new component version or a new microservice version in just really seconds. And I just realized that we're talking about all of this, but we didn't really mention what we're talking about specifically.
Right. Well, and I think we're just kind of like setting up the problem. But one of the things you just mentioned about having a virtual machine, right? Like, let's say you're using a virtual box.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to install a different version of PHP, or you want to install a different version of MySQL or whatever it happens to be, or you want to switch from Apache to Nginx, you're probably now maintaining two separate ISOs, right? The old style virtual machines.
Yeah.
And each one of those is several gigabytes on your drive, and you have to spin one up, and that uses a certain amount of memory and processor. Mm-hmm. You have to spin it down, you have to spin the other one up, and then that one's using memory and processor. You probably can't be running several of them at the same time. There's a lot of overhead with the old style of virtual machines.
Right. Exactly. And even though, so with virtual machines, there are several approaches. You either download the entire firewall with the predefined set of tools and versions, and yeah, that's basically the entire Linux operating system with all of the dependencies and packages installed, which really can be gigabytes that you have to download and store somewhere. If you want different versions of PHP, one option is just to have different base boxes, and now you multiply that storage space and traffic that has to be used for download twice or three times. Another approach is you just have your base box and then you use something like Chef, Ansible, or Puppet to provision it, and you basically just reprovision your box, change configuration. Hopefully it's just a configuration somewhere in the provisioning script, or you have to change parts of that script to install a different PHP version or a different Apache version, or swap Apache with Nginx. And then you wait for 10 to 20 minutes, whatever it takes to reprovision it, which is installing all of the packages, downloading them, installing, maybe compiling. So it's a time-consuming process. And one of the frustrations that usually happen pretty often is that as you provision, so let's say you have a working, like I'll give you an example, the VDD project, the Vagrant development box for Drupal. It can be really nice that everything is kind of put together for you. It's a provisioning script and recipes, and you can just run it. But unfortunately, dependencies change over time. So while you provisioned it and it worked today, in months from now, or let's say 2 months from now, something else has changed, and now this provisioning doesn't work because you have to change some version or URL or something else. The dependency is now different. And that's why often people will find that things just don't work. So you try to reprovision it, but it doesn't work. So now you have to figure out why is it broken? Why is this thing, it used to work, now it doesn't work? That's one of the frustrations that come from this approach of kind of reprovisioning the environment using a preset set of provisioning scripts or recipes.
Yeah, I guess this is a good point then to say, We have another way of doing this, and we have mentioned on the show quite a lot in the past. It's called Docker, and that's kind of like the basis for sort of like what's the next generation of not just local development environments, but I think it's particularly well suited to the kinds of problems that we're talking about when you're dealing with your local machine, because you use a lot less resources. Once you get it kind of set up, it's pretty easy to change something. You can change a version of PHP, you could change from Apache to Nginx, you could change your database backend, and you could add new libraries and new extensions and things like that. And the recompile time is almost zero, right?
Well, the compilation time is still not going anywhere. But the biggest difference with Docker is that containers are really lightweight. And they are lightweight from different perspectives. They are much smaller in size because container only holds what is necessary for a particular service. It only holds the kind of minimal operating system. For example, the latest version of Ubuntu is about, I think, 188 megabytes. The latest version of Debian is only 85 megabytes in size. Compare that to the full install of Debian or Ubuntu, which could be several gigabytes. And then on top of that, you have layers with additional provisioning kind of commands that you run. So you start with a base image of Ubuntu, CentOS, Debian, anything else you want. And you just add on to that, you install, let's say, PHP packages, you install your web server. Though ideally, Docker's paradigm is to run a single process per container or a single service per container. That's where the idea of microservices comes in. But still, even to configure PHP decently, you not only need to install the packages, but you also want to apply particular configuration. You may want to, let's say for PHP container, you may want to install Composer, you may want to install Drush specifically to work with Drupal and things like that. And all of those instructions, they are defined in a Docker file. And then when containers or images are built, each instruction becomes its own layer, basically. So that's why it's said that Docker is using a layered file system. So in the very bottom layer, we have the base image that was used, so the base operating system, let's say, and then we're adding layers on top of that for all other things that we want to install into our image. And then images is the same thing like base boxes in terms of Vagrant, but the size is drastically less. So instead of gigabytes, we're talking maybe several hundreds of megabytes. So containers are lightweight in size, or actually images, because you download an image, and then when you run an image, it becomes a container. They're also lightweight on resources because you are not running the entire copy of the operating system, but you are really just running a single process, or maybe a group of processes inside of the container. And then the way Docker works, or Linux containers work, they are eventually just control groups in Linux. And the idea is not new. I think it was first introduced in 2007 or 8, so quite a while ago. And really just a way to isolate a particular process, give it a particular set of resources like disk, CPU, memory, network, and so on, and just have it running in this isolated bubble. And then you can connect different containers together so they can talk to each other. So one of the other issues with traditional virtual machines and virtual private servers that Docker addresses or containers address is the density. So you can have a lot more containers running on a single physical host compared to how many virtual machines, like full virtual machines, you would be able to run. And the third thing is the virtualization overhead. You do have it with virtual machines, and these are the numbers I just saw somewhere recently. I don't know how correct or close to the reality they are, but obviously there is a tax on using virtualization. It can be anywhere between 1 to 5% on CPU and maybe 5 to 10% or so on the memory. And specifically with VirtualBox, that's a really poor job virtualizing CPU cores. You will get a lot better performance by just defaulting or switching to a single core. Because when you do more than a single core, the overhead of virtualizing cores becomes a lot higher than the actual benefit that you may be getting it because your application is able to utilize multiple cores. So to recap, it's the size, it's the density, the number of containers that can be run on the physical host, and it's also the absence of the virtualization overhead.
Okay, so the fact that it's all compartmentalized, right? I think the first context I ever heard about that was because of security, and that people that are doing Docker hosting now, one of the promises is it's much more hardened against certain kinds of attacks, because if I can mess around with your PHP process, that doesn't mean that I have now write access to everything else on your machine, because that PHP container only knows about the files that are inside of that PHP container, and everything else it does is basically talking over sockets or like network essentially kind of stuff. So there's that as a big advantage. And like you said, you can run, you know, where you could only really run like, you know, three or four or five virtual machines on one piece of hardware. Since these little containers are so small and so self-contained, you can run, depending on what your machine is and what your use case is, whatever, but you can run like hundreds or thousands of these things on a beefy enough machine. And one thing people may be familiar with is Pantheon. They use something very similar to containers, and they're, you know, they say they can run like 1,000 sites on one machine or something like that. Really crazy. So yeah, I mean, there's a lot of benefits, but there are some things that you then have to deal with, right? Right, like the affordances. Like, what's the cost for somebody who's never done this before? That now I'm using Docker, now I'm using containers, now I'm using microservices that are all these little self-contained things. Like, deciding where you put your files can, it's a question, I guess, once you figure it out, once you can sort of have everything set up, or in the case of what you're talking about with this product, and maybe there's a good time to introduce Drood, is that you, as the chief architect, have sort of made a lot of the decisions for the 100 and something people that are going to be using it. So now what you're really talking about is, how do we need to customize this set of decisions for this individual project? And then you, five or six people that are working on this project, you just work with that same set of assumptions, right?
Right. So yeah, with Drood, the idea is that it is basically one of the options to orchestrate containers and to use Docker containers for your local environment needs. The space for container orchestration is really hot right now. It's a really hot topic. Everyone is trying to come up with their own product for managing containers, for managing storage with containers, for networking, for managing huge clusters of containers. So I think it's like endless, and there are so many different options, so much competition, and this space changes every week or maybe a month with something new coming up. And this is across the board with the Docker space. I think specifically with Drupal, there are companies that are using Docker or containers for hosting, like Pantheon is using containers. I don't know if they are using Docker specifically. They are using Linux containers. Platform SH is also using containers. They have a really cool solution. I really like how you can fork the entire environment, and it's forking not only the Git branch, but the actual entire environment with all of the stack components. I know Acre is actually thinking about getting their foot in the door with containers as well. I don't know how far they are with that and when it's going to be announced, even in the closed beta phase. We're not trying to address production hosting. I would really leave that out to those big guys who are going to spend millions of dollars on figuring out how to host Drupal sites or how to manage clusters of containers using Docker.
Well, and the problem that you're trying to solve with Drood is specifically for the developers at FFW.
Yeah, specifically,
right?
Specifically for the developers. Drood stands for Drupal Docker Environment. It actually used to be Drupal development environments in its first phase when I used Vagrant and Ansible to provision a Vagrant base box. Docker, that was, I think, in November last year when I was experimenting with Vagrant and Ansible, and Docker is really changing. It's a work in progress. New things are coming up, and I think their release cycle is now 2 months. So it's the bleeding edge. You really have to be up to speed with that, and it's changing. So we're trying to be up to speed with that. We're trying to put together something that will be usable for developers. And I think in January, they released a set of features which made it finally usable on Mac, because containers, they only work on Linux. They need a Linux core, because that's what they run on top of. And Mac is not really running. Mac is not Linux, and Windows is not Linux. I think January this year, there was a release of a thing that is called Boot to Docker, which allows you to run Docker containers on Mac and Windows, and they introduced, I think, finally the sharing options, so you can actually share files between your host machine and your containers on Mac and Windows. And that's when it finally made sense. We could finally start using it or experimenting it for the local dev environments, because before that, it was primarily Linux, and really Linux. We have some developers who are using Linux as their development environment or their host, but really most of our users are either Mac or Windows. So we need a solution that will work for those. And to run Docker on Mac or Windows, as I mentioned, we need boot to Docker. And, well, that is still a virtual machine. We're not getting anywhere from virtual machines on Windows and Mac, because we do need a Linux virtual machine. But the good thing is that boot to Docker is really lightweight. It's only 25 or so megabytes in size. It starts really fast, and it really has only the Linux core and some really, really basic tools to be able to run Docker containers. So that's how things can work finally and on Windows and Mac, and people can use Docker on Windows and Mac.
Very cool.
And then with Druid, as we were talking, how people can customize it for their needs. So the idea with Druid is that it is installed into a repo, a project repo. And by installing, I mean just dropping in some files like the Docker Compose YAML file, which defines the composition of the stack, like what microservices are you going to use, what are the base images for those, what is the configuration, and some folder mappings. So once all that is configured, all I have to do as a newcomer to a project, I just clone the repo and I run a command to start this thing up, like Docker Compose app, and it basically just provisions the entire thing. It downloads the necessary base images, it starts the containers, supplies the configuration, links them together, and Druid has a tool called DSH, which stands for Druid Shell. And this is one of the key components to Druid, which manages the whole stack. To really make it usable and not only be able to provision the stack, but also to provision the entire site, we have an option to define your custom init script. And that's where you download the database dump from Acquia or from a local SQL file. You import it, you probably rsync files, or you enable the stage file proxy, you apply some local configuration, and then you get the entire site running. So in a single command, I can get the entire stack provisioned, as well as the site itself provisioned using a database dump or whatever, maybe run the profile installation, and it's up and running. And now I can do development instead of trying to figure out how to set up the stack and get the site up and running.
Okay, so once you have sort of Druid and you have that environment, you have that init script, you're talking about, like, you know, maybe 30 seconds to a minute to boot the whole thing up, as opposed to whatever, you know, all the other problems that we had before with virtualization and with Vagrant and everything, because everything's kind of already there.
Well, you still have to download, you still have to download the images, but the images are downloaded once for your environments, for your entire Druid environment. So let's say if I need an Apache image, I need a PHP 5.6 image, I need a MySQL 5.5 or 5.6 image. So those are downloaded once and stored locally. And then once they are downloaded, which I think the total size of these images may still be about 1 gigabyte or so. But once they are downloaded, they can be easily reused on different projects. So the first time, it would probably take 5 to 10 minutes, depending on your internet connection. I think for me, it takes maybe like 5 minutes, maybe even less. But then once I have those images in place, starting the containers really takes seconds. So it's maybe 5 seconds, maybe up to 10 seconds if something takes a bit longer to start. And restarting them takes also seconds, not sometimes minutes like with virtual machines. And then if I work in a second project and I already have all of the images in place on my local computer, starting that project will also just take seconds because containers boot really fast. They don't have to boot the entire operating system core because it's already in place and they work on top of it.
And then if I want to get at like that site from my local web browser, is it just simple just as adding into the host file, or is there something a little bit crazier that I have to do?
So yeah, you do have to either modify your host file to point whatever domain you want to use to Drut's IP address, or another solution, which is in development branch right now for Drut, is to point your resolve.conf or modify your resolve.conf file to tell it what DNS server is going to resolve all requests to .drut domains. So in this way, you can either install DNS mask on your Mac, or what we have with Drut is the DNS mask is already inside there in a tiny container. It's about 5 megabytes in size because it just has DNS mask and that's it. And it replies to anything.drut with the Drut's IP address. And with Mac, it's really easy to configure it with the resolve files, resolve.conf files. Anything that is .drut resolves to the Drut Docker host.
So I could have a September 11th memorial.drut instead of .com or whatever it happens to be. Mm-hmm. And it just works.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool. And then I'm assuming then you also have to set up your... inside your Drut script, you know, your the vhost for that machine obviously has to reply to that, but you would know you were going to do that ahead of time.
Right. Yeah, Drut also has a vhost proxy, which is basically an Nginx proxy, which does the routing. So since there are multiple containers, potentially, there can be multiple containers that may want to listen on port 80, you either have to use a unique port, so let's say 80, 81, 82, and so on, if you want to run many of them at the same time or concurrently, or you have to assign them individual IP addresses. So we have that as an option as well with Drut. That's what we started with. But then this approach with vhost proxy works much better. And the way it works is there is a tiny microservice, which I call vhost proxy, that runs Nginx inside it, and it reacts to any container stopping or starting by reading the vhost configuration for that container and then reconfiguring itself, or actually reconfiguring Nginx. So then Nginx is listening on port 80 on the primary IP for the Drut VM, and then it routes the request based on that virtual host to the particular container that has that vhost name assigned.
That is when this really, I think, for me, just went like, okay, this is worth me taking a few minutes to figure out how to set it up, right? So let's talk about that. So it's on GitHub, right? You can go to github.com/blinkreaction/Drut. Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct.
And then from there, there's sort of like a set of installation instructions that tells you you have to install boot to Docker, you have to install a couple of other packages and get some things set up. But then what's the setup process like? If I want to start from downloading that Drut off of GitHub to now having it for my, you know, let's say that it's my personal blog or something like that.
So the setup process is outlined there, but basically what we have is, and it's still a bit of a work in progress, so don't judge us too hard. We're welcome to pull requests and issue submissions. But you basically first, you install the basic requirements like the VirtualBox. We do depend on Vagrant, so we are not actually going away from Vagrant because Vagrant makes it much easier to manage a virtual machine. So we still have to provision the boot to Docker virtual machine. We still have to provision or set up file sharing. Like it's for Mac, it's NFS, for Windows, it's SMB. And Vagrant makes it just much easier. So instead of writing this together and operating with just kind of raw shell commands or console VBox manage commands, Vagrant takes care of a lot of that, and that's why we still depend on Vagrant, because it makes my much easier to control the actual VM with which accesses the Docker host. And the base for that VM is the stock boot to Docker image, which is maintained and supported by the Docker team. So once you have that in place, and let's say you have a repo with a project, we have this DSH tool, which is Druid shell. So you install it globally in your system, and from there you can control the environment. I think we are working on the automated installation procedure, like to get Druid actually in, it is already in place. You just install DSH and then you follow the instructions to install Druid into your project repo. And really all that is installed in your project repo is the Docker Compose file. And Docker Compose is again a tool from the Docker team, which acts as the orchestration tool for containers. That's where we define the stack composition with what microservices, what base images, what configuration, how things are linked together. So really, you only add one extra file to your repo to be able to start using Druid.
But for that file, like, can I use the default one, or do I kind of need to add some of my own stuff to it? I mean, I have to do something a little bit site-specific, project-specific in order to kind of get that going.
You can start with the default one, and we don't currently have too much documentation as for how you could customize that, because right now it's still an internal project, though it's open-sourced. The idea is that for team leads on our projects would customize it, as well as the init script for a particular project. So let's say instead of PHP version 5.3, they want to use 5.5. Instead of a particular MySQL version, they want to use a different one. Or let's say someone needs Memcache on their project to test how Memcache is actually working, or maybe Varnish or Solr. All of those microservices, we have a library of images for them. And all you do, you can open the default Docker Compose file. Some of them are commented out. You just read through the comments and you basically just uncomment a block of code, let's say for a Memcached microservice. You restart containers and now you have Memcached up and running. So one more step that has to be performed manually right now is that the settings.php file has to be altered to work with Druid. So you have to point Drupal to the database in the database container. And there are a couple more minor workarounds that are needed to get the file system working properly. But other than that, it's primarily just pointing Drupal to the database container, and you are good to go.
All right. Sounds very cool. Is there anything that you can talk about publicly about, like, who is using this, or, you know, sort of like a success story for Druid yet? Or is it still kind of early on? I mean, I know it's really under very active development. We have an internal chat room where people are posting new stuff about it every day.
So we are already using it. We are piloting this in a couple projects, maybe more than a couple, several projects. And developers were really happy. Well, first of all, it's finally that standardized environment. We've been talking about using Vagrant for months, if not years, but that never really took off for whatever reason. But now I have a strong goal to make this happen with Docker, with a standardized environment. And also people are really excited how easy it is to, let's say, I need Solr. I need to test something on Acquia. It's already there. But for my local development, I need to test something with Solr. And I need a particular version of Solr. So we put together and a base image with Solr, and now it's available for everyone to use. So you just add or uncomment that section for the Solr microservice in your Docker Compose file. You restart your containers, and now you have Solr available. You just point your Drupal site to that Solr container, and you could do whatever you need to do with Solr. So this modular approach, the ease with which you can swap components out or add new components, is really the power of Docker in containers. And one of the other goals with Root is for it really to be a collection of best practices as well. So a collection of particular approaches of how we do things to reflect best practices in the development process, best practices as for which tools should be used, how they can be used, and so on. So my goal with Root is to turn it into kind of the entire local development ecosystem for our developers, with not only stack, but also the tools that we want to use. They're already pre-configured, the way it makes sense for the team, and people don't really have to go through this setup and configuration process. They just get it by installing it, and they can start using it. We do plan to put together trainings as well, and we plan to, at some point, make them publicly available so others can start using Root as well and benefit from it.
Great. I just want to clarify one thing. That Docker Compose YAML file, that's the only thing I need to put in my project repository. Like, everything else is really just part of like the sort of like the global system. Is that right?
Yeah. So there are two things besides the prerequisites, which are the Vagrant and VirtualBox. You install the DSH tool, which is Root shell, in your user local bin. So that kind of manages and orchestrates everything. But inside of the actual repository, it's just the Docker Compose YAML file. So it's similar to the package JSON or anything else, like a packaging tool. It's pretty much similar to that. It's just a file that defines what images and what microservices should be started for this particular project. If you do want to mess around with PHP configuration and MySQL configuration, or if you want to add the init script, then it's not yet reflected in the documentation because we're transitioning right now a little, but you will be adding a .root folder in the repo, and you will be putting that stuff in it. So in the .root, you will have a itsy folder with, let's say, MySQL configuration overrides, PHP configuration overrides, and your .root init script.
Okay. Since we work together, I may be volunteering myself by saying this, but yeah, I would love to see, you know, a repository on GitHub that just has like an example project, maybe with even like with a Drush make file in it, you know, just sort of like, this is everything you would need to get started with, just like a really simple, here's a Drupal blog site, and maybe it even downloads like an install profile from Drupal.org, just as an example of here is something that you could do with a practical project. And I know you said, right, that you're working on tutorials, you're working on sort of like some publicly available resources that are not just proprietary to FFW employees. So yeah, we'll try to make sure to mention those on a future episode of the podcast when it comes out. And as always, you can find our podcast, and we have notes and links to everything that we just talked about at drupaleasy.com/podcast. So you can go check that out. So any more like parting thoughts about Root? I mean, we have been talking about it for quite a while. I feel like we covered a lot.
Yeah, I can talk about Docker and Root forever. So specifically about the tutorial or example project, that's a great idea. I was actually thinking about putting that together today because I'm going to give a talk about Docker and Root at the New York City camp tomorrow or on Saturday. I think they're switching the schedule right now. So it's either Friday or Saturday. But yeah, I think that that's one of the really important things to have to get people up to speed really fast with an example project. So that's a great suggestion. And I already had this in my mind to put something up on GitHub so people can just clone it and do DSH up and have a running Drupal site and experience the Drupal magic.
Awesome. So that is kind of wrapping up the interview portion of the show. Normally, right now, we would have news stories. I think just in the interest of the fact that there's just you and I, we might just skip over the news. Sorry if anyone out there was waiting for that to happen. There were some interesting stories that came out in the Drupal world this week. One was talking about whether or not, you know, people should be making modules that you pay for rather than just open source and free on Drupal.org. And I think the big question about that is, you know, if you put out this thing open source, who's supporting it? And what sort of like level of quality is someone expecting? But for now, I think we're just going to move right on to the picks of the week. I'll go first, Lennon, just so you can get an idea of what I'm talking about. It's just really simple. There's a project that I actually have to use it for my job, you know, all the time, because the client that we're working with requires that we send them a coder report. But turns out that it also just makes me feel really good that I know I can run my code through the sort of like, you know, style guide check and make sure that all of my comments end with a period, and that when I say that this implements this hook, that it actually has the parentheses at the end, and the coder review will remind me, just even if it's just only about formatting the comments, if everything else you did was perfect, it'll also remind you, hey, there's an extra space at the end of this line. And so when you go, you know, to check in your code, you know that you're checking in not only code that works, but that looks right and has all the right sort of like syntax also, and based on the Drupal coding style. So it's just called Coder, the project itself, and it installs a little tool on the Drush command line, which is where I think most people use it. And it does require an extra library, but the Coder report, totally worth your time. Do check it out. So do you have anything, Leonard, that's like an interesting tool? Maybe it's related to Docker, maybe it's not. Maybe it's a tutorial that somebody has that you say like, oh, you have to go read this one post because this, you know, this helped me out a lot recently.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the spirit of Docker, I'm going to suggest something Docker related because that's really what I'm focusing on right now. And as I said, I can talk about it forever. I've recently discovered that with Docker, you could like there are a lot of base images. You can use Ubuntu, you can use Debian, or you can use CentOS and so on. But those images are anywhere between 1 to 200 megabytes. And sometimes for something really tiny, like we were talking about the DNS mask microservice, you don't really need that whole thing. You don't really need all of the pre-installed packages. But fortunately, there is a really nice Linux version, which is called, and there are actually many of them, but one that is in particular pretty active right now in the Docker community is called Alpine Linux. And the base image is really tiny. It's only like 5 megabytes, so or maybe even 3 megabytes. So my microservers for DNS mask is based on that. And once DNS mask is installed, the entire image is about like 4 or 4.5 or 5 megabytes. So it is really tiny. And I think for some really tiny small things, like a DNS service or maybe an Nginx proxy, this is a really good solution because the outcome image is so tiny and you don't really need anything else. So anyone trying to kind of figure out how to optimize your Docker images, and if you have really small tool, maybe it's even if it's just a binary that you want to have, check it out. Alpine Linux Docker images is a really good option for that.
Very, very cool. Well, that brings us pretty close to the end of the show. There is a couple of events that we would like to plug. If you are, you know, into doing some core development stuff, there is going to be a Midwest Developer Summit in August. And I want to say that's in Chicago, but I'm clicking on the link right now to be sure. So hosted by Palantir, I guess. And do check that out. It's August 12th through the 15th. If you're in the area, go develop some Drupal core. And then the other one, it's still a little ways off, but it has been announced for the 2015 dates, is near me, Drupal Camp Atlanta, October 16th and 17th, and it's going to be at the Kennesaw State University. Any other events? I know, Leonard, you said you're going to be going to Nice Camp this weekend, so maybe by the time that everyone hears this, it'll be over. But anything else you know that's coming up that you're going to be checking out?
Yes, but it's not Drupal-related. It's going to be a World Maker Fair in the end of September, and it's a really it's going to happen in New York City, and that's a really cool thing, place for an event for geeks and people interested in like cool new tech, new toys, Arduino, and that kind of stuff. But as well for just makers, putting something together from a pile of something else, and for kids, that's a really great place for kids as well, because there are so many different activities there, and I'm definitely going to attend it.
Yeah, I went up there 1 year. It was amazing. Like, we have a maker fair in Orlando, but it's nothing like the sort of like one of the big ones. So definitely, yeah, if you could be anywhere in the world and still want to check that out. There's a Mousetrap. If you remember the board game Mousetrap from the 1980s, they set up a life-sized version of it with the man in the diving suit is actually like a full-size man, and the mice are people dressed up as mice. It's ridiculous. Yeah, and lots of things that spit fire, right? I mean,
yeah, that can happen as well.
What else can you have other than a unicorn spitting fire? That's the best part, clearly. Well, very cool. So, Leonard, do you have like a personal website or someplace you want to point people to? Maybe even just your GitHub page?
Yeah, that would be just the GitHub page. I was thinking about blogging about my achievements, but never really found time for that. So I don't use Twitter. I don't have a personal blog. You can just follow what I'm doing in the dev space on my GitHub profile.
All right, very cool. So you go by L. Makarov, which is spelled just like your name?
Mm-hmm.
All right. And again, yeah, the links to that will be on the show notes. So there is one last thing, which we ask all of our guests, these five questions. They're pretty fun. What's something that you do for fun or as a hobby outside of Drupal?
I have a six-year-old son, and we started skiing with him when he was just three. So that's really something I like a lot. And we don't go too far. We're in Jersey, so we go in the Poconos. But it was amazing seeing him trying to ski first time. And then the next year when we actually hired an instructor, just I think a couple times, and the instructor fixed everything, so he was able to just ski on his own and do it the right way. So that was amazing, seeing a little kid skiing down the Black Diamond slopes.
Very cool. So what was the last piece of software you installed? It could be an app on your phone, it could be a game, or it could be, you know, a development tool.
Well, actually, talking about app on a phone, there is a really cool one. I'm really into new technology and new cool stuff, and I read about this on Facebook. One of my friends posted. It's called Revolut, and it's actually a credit card that is connected to different accounts with different currencies. I think it's the British pound, dollar, and euro. And you can load it with money from your regular credit or debit card. And then you can use it for travel purposes, because there is no fee for the overseas transactions. And also the currency conversion rates do not apply, because it's going to use whichever currency is applicable in that particular place. So if you're traveling to Europe, you can just load funds with your American credit card and convert them into euros, and the conversion rate is going to be whatever you see on google.com when you Google for how many pounds is $1 or how many euros. And yeah, there are no fees, and I'm going to Europe in just basically several days, going back to Ukraine, and so I'm going to try it out there.
And it actually comes with like a physical card?
Yeah. So it first you register, and you get a virtual card, so you see your card number, expiration date, and PIN. And then in about 10 days, you are going to receive a physical card with the chip, so it can be used in Canada, it can be used in Europe. It's a pretty cool thing, specifically for traveling purposes.
Yeah. So what's something that you'd like to do that you're still kind of on the fence about? Something that, you know, maybe is still a little scary, like, you know, one day I'd like to you know, jump out of an airplane or something like that?
Well, I already jumped it from an airplane last year. That was my birthday present from my wife. So I always wanted to do that. Of course, I didn't do it myself. It was with an instructor, so it was not so terrifying. It was still really, really scary. But another thing that I always wanted to do is bungee jumping. So I would really love to go to New Zealand and jump from a really high bridge and have the like mountain river down there. Hopefully, I will not get killed by that.
That sounds like a lot of fun, but also something that I would never do. You can't get me to walk on like a suspension bridge most of the time.
It's scary. Just walking on a bridge maybe, but when you're already on the edge, it's just the kind of first maybe 500 milliseconds that you are scared to death, and then it's pretty irrelevant because you're already going down.
Yeah.
No way back.
All right. Have you fed any exotic animals recently? Like, you know, not just like dogs and cats, but something fun?
Exotic animals. Well, I think the last trip that we had when we interacted with exotic animals was probably to Iceland. And that's not really an exotic animal, but in Iceland, they have their own breed of horses that you cannot find anywhere else, and they are really amazing. And we just met some of them. We were just driving somewhere, and it was in the middle of the winter, so everything, snow everywhere. And we just saw a bunch of horses, and they came to us, and we just fed them with some, I think we had some bread or so. So yeah, that was pretty exciting, because they are so nice.
Okay, and finally, can you tell us about a moment that, you know, you said that you got into Drupal because of your job, but when was the moment when you really felt like you were invested in Drupal and, you know, it was sort of like, we call it the moment where you had your tipping point of Drupal, where you really felt like, I'm here, I'm doing the right place, you know, I'm with the right people, something like that.
Yeah, I think that point was when I realized that hooks exist in Drupal. So no more hacking core, you should be using hooks and the API.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Leonard, for being here. You know, we are have this podcast comes out just about every 2 weeks, and you could subscribe to it by going to drupaleasy.com/podcast, clicking on the links in the sidebar, and we are on the iTunes store and the different podcast directories, including Stitcher, which is a really great way if you're not used to doing podcasts to get into Stitcher. And then we post, you know, some news stories that we might be talking about every week on Delicious using the tag Drupal Easy Podcast. And actually, if you out there are a Delicious tag user, you can use the same tag and we'll see the story. You can also call us on our phone number, which is 321-396-2340, and leave us a voicemail. We'll play it on the show. If you talk about your cats and cheesecakes, we'll be there with you to try and figure out if you have a Drupal question or a story that you want to share, something like that. And last but not least, I have to say the magic words.
See ya. Content types. They want it cheap. Errors and warnings and notices all over. Who wrote this thing? Bleep. Agony. No frustration more sore. For those kittens were killed when some stupid idiot hacked core. This template file has a PHP class. No, it's unthemable. Then there's the 2 gigs of JS and SAS. It's unredeemable. I could just screamable. Agony! Oh, it fills me with rage. Why is it loading so slow?
Did you log in yet?
No, there's a flash landing page. Agony! Such a sad femurs must weep. The rate the sight's crawling, it's just so appalling, it puts us to sleep. If it were not for the widget.
A widget's no fun, there's just one.
It's a blunder.
Then tear it asunder like this, display none.
When we're at an impasse, it's my thing about sass.
Well, it's crass.
It's no crasser than your thing with flash.
Flash!
Flash.
Flash is very upsetting.
Not forgetting. The scope's
unachievable, website's unscalable, if it's conceivable, contracts available.
Agony, misery, war, the site won't even run.
Can you wrap this up, please? We need to introduce Dries.
Okay, we're almost done. Agony, do you see what I see? W-S-O-D.
Wow. Even coder and